been a good day. I cannot imagine what it's like to have been a professor of homiletics and hear one of your students in the morning. Dennis Guernsey was one of my students. It's kind of hard to believe that back then when he was in seminary, he was cocky. I remember one time we were, you know, teaching about illustrations, and he didn't use illustrations. So I grabbed him by the hair, and I shook him. So he learned his lesson well. Tomorrow morning, Lord willing, when we have our seminar session, several of you are ministers, and we have had some interesting conversations, and asked Bob if we could do this. So we're going to have a session during that seminar session for folks interested in homiletics, spend a while just talking about preaching. So if that's where you're at and you'd like to do that tomorrow, we'll announce where we'll be, but I thought I'd mention this along the way. The whole thing is just about communication. Communication is difficult. It has a way of breaking down. Back in Colorado, where I come from, up in the mountains, they have a rule. That is that the car coming down the mountain is given preference over the car going up the mountain. And a while ago, a state trooper was going up the mountain, and as he did, he saw a car coming down around the curve, so he pulled over to let the car pass, and the car came around the mountain, and the woman stuck her hand out of the window, and she yelled at this policeman, "Pig! Pig! Pig!" I mean, he didn't think he deserved that. He said, "Yes, sow, sow, sow!" And then he went around the curve, and he hit a pig. I've been trying to figure out why so many of you showed up this week after a number of you stopped me last night and told me I had absolutely nothing to do with your coming. I figured that the reason that you're here is that you can come this week and not miss the Olympics or the Democratic Convention or the Republican Convention. And I really think the Democratic Convention, the Republican Convention have got to be the best thing on television this summer. I mean, it really is. It's high comedy. The thing that strikes me is I think they're taking it seriously. But, a while ago on Broadway, there was a satire entitled Of Thee I Sing. And the opening scene of that satire took place in a smoke-filled hotel room. Group of politicians had found a candidate that they thought they could run, but they were looking for a platform on which their man might run. And one of them felt that if they could ask a chambermaid, she might be able to tell them what the people of the country wanted. And so they consulted the chambermaid, and she said that what the people of the nation wanted was love. And so love became the major plank in the platform. There's one way in which that musical was right in tune with our times. Everybody's in love with love. It ranks up there with apple pie and ice cream, baseball and Toyotas. But you always have to be a bit suspicious of something that everybody embraces. And it seems to me that everybody lays claim on love. The pornographers sprinkle the titles of their books and films with love. Homosexuals and lesbians sometimes sound as though they had invented it. It was George Bernard Shaw who said, "When you look for deeds done in the name of love, where do you look?" And his wry answer was, "In the murder columns of newspapers." And yet, in spite of the fact that the word love is devalued currency, we as Christians can't throw it aside as though it were Confederate money. because the New Testament is clear that the basic expression of our Christian faith is love. The New Testament says it again and again. Paul says that the fruit of the Spirit's work in our life is love. But love is the fulfilling of the law. When he wrote to the Christians in Rome, he told them that they were to owe no man anything except to love one another. And in his Thessalonian correspondence, in that first letter in chapter 4, he said, "You have no need that anyone write to tell you to love. God himself is telling you to do that." And on our Lord's last night before his crucifixion, he gathered his men around him and he said to them, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, because you love one another." And Paul drives that same point home in 1 Corinthians 13. In the first stanza of this great anthem of love, Paul is saying that apart from love, all of our gifts, all of our service, all of our sacrifice accomplishes nothing, makes us nothing, and gains us nothing when we stand before God. Since it is the truth of the New Testament that those who do not love do not know God, the question that is before us is a question that Cole Porter raised decades ago. He asked, "What is this thing called love, this foolish thing called love?" I asked the Lord in heaven above, "What is this thing called love?" I'm not surprised that Cole Porter would ask. In our culture, anything gets labeled love. I am surprised that he had enough good sense to ask the Lord in heaven above for the answer. And in 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7, Paul gives the reply. And in this stanza of this great chapter, Paul is showing us what love is by describing what love does. The word that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 13 for love is the Greek word agape. The Greeks had a number of different words to talk about different kinds of love. They could talk about the love of passion. They could talk about the love of parents. They could talk about the love of patriots. But those words could not capture what the New Testament writers wanted to express when they talked about God's love for us and our love for him and our love for others. And so they took this word agape outside of the New Testament in classical Greek writing. The word is seldom used. In fact, in its noun form, it is used only four times, as far as we know, outside of the Bible. And in each case, it is a weak and anemic word. It could be translated goodwill. But the New Testament writers took this word agape and baptized it into the Christian faith, and they filled it full of meaning. And it is the major word the New Testament uses to speak of God's love for us and the love that we are to have for others. And the distinguishing mark of agape love is that it is not a love that focuses on our feelings. Instead, it is a set of the mind, an attitude of life, an act of the will, whereby we seek other people's highest good, and we deliberately put other people's interests before our own. It's because agape love is not love of the emotions that Jesus could say in the Sermon on the Mount, "Love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, do good to those who despitefully use you." Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, read those words of Jesus and dismissed them as absurd. "It's impossible," he said, "to command love." And of course, if you were talking about emotional love, the great philosopher was absolutely right. Because you cannot conjure up love of the emotional kind as one might light a candle or extinguish it as one might blow out a match. And if you wait to love your enemies until you have warm feelings for them, you will wait until both you and your enemy have died. But it is possible, and this is what the New Testament is saying, that whether I am dealing with friend or foe, I can treat every man as an act of the will, as someone whose highest good I seek, whose best interests I place before my own. That is what agape love is. As long as you keep it on that kind of abstract level, it doesn't really get through to us. It's all very nice to say that to be Christians who love people, we are to seek other people's highest good. But until we bring it down to life, until we tie it into experience, we can all pretty well feel that we're as loving as the next fellow. It reminds me of Charles Schulz's Peanuts cartoon. In one of the episodes, Linus announces that he wants to be a physician. And Lucy, his sister, says, you a doctor? You can't be a doctor. You don't love mankind. To which Linus responds, I do so love mankind. It's people I can't stand. But if we are ever going to love, we do not simply love as an abstraction. We have to love people. And that's why in 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7, Paul shows us agape love in action. He shows us what this love is by showing us what this love does. If you look at the section, you discover that Paul uses 15 different phrases to show us love at work in the world. The first two phrases, Paul says, love is patient and love is kind. Those two words, those two phrases are like an umbrella over everything else that follows. They summarize the rest of the list. And then after having said that love is patient and love is kind, Paul gives us eight things that love does not do. He says it does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. Love is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It's not irritable. It keeps no records of wrong. Love does not delight in evil. And then, having given us eight negatives, Paul gives us five positives. He says, love rejoices with the truth. It always protects. It always trusts. It always hopes. It always perseveres. The first two things, then, that Paul says about love that is a summary statement of all that follows is that this agape love is always patient and it's always kind. When Paul says that love is patient, the Greek word that is used here is always used of patience with people. It is never used of patience with circumstances. We are often impatient with patience. We sometimes think of patience as the virtue of the elderly or the infirm who are too feeble to do much else but be patient. We think of patience as the virtue of the insensitive who don't have enough sense to know that action needs to be taken. But no virtue can really be a virtue if there is not patience. William Shakespeare understood that when he said that love is not love that alters when an alteration finds. If I'm willing to love you only insofar as you please me, only insofar as you do what I want you to do, and if you don't please me and don't do what I want, I withdraw my love, then that's not love at all. That's a form of manipulation that is really an expression of selfishness. But love must be patient, because there is no such thing as love. There's no great vault of love up in heaven. There's only somebody loving and somebody being loved. And If we are going to love, then we're going to love people. And as Christians, we must be realists. One thing that the Bible teaches about all of us is that we suffer from a curvature of the soul, that the sin seeps into our inner beings. And whether we are Christians or not Christians, we all have hang-ups. We all have parents that raised us right or raised us wrong. We all have frustrations. We all are sinful. And if I can't love sinful people, I can't love. Those are the only folks that are running around. And if I insist that people be perfect before I love them, I will never get around to loving. If love is to be love, it must love people who are sinful, who are frustratingly inconsistent, who are often immature, who often lie to me and lie about me, say things behind my back or rude things to my face. If I don't love people like that, I'm not going to love, because love must be directed towards folks who are sinful. When Paul wrote to the Christians in Colossae, he said a lovely thing. In chapter 3, he said, make allowance for one another, because you love one another. That was simply Paul's way of saying, all of us are sinners. All of us are inconsistent. All of us rub other people raw. But if you love folks, you make allowance for them. Love is patient. But not only is love patient, love is kind. Those two things go together like a couple in a good marriage. They complement one another. Patience by itself can be passive. In fact, patience by itself can be indifference. I can be patient with injustice if the injustice is not directed at me. I can be patient with injustice sometimes simply because I'm too weak to do anything about it. But to be patient with someone who frustrates me, to be patient with somebody who gets on my nerves, and then to act towards that person in kindness, that is a triumph of love. And one of the things that ought to characterize us as God's people in the world is that we're always saying the kind word, doing the kind deed. We ought to be characterized by what Wordsworth called those little unremembered acts of kindness and love. That ought just be a quality of life. Ian McLaren was a great Scotch preacher. He used to say to his people again and again, life is an uphill climb, and people are hurting and weary. Therefore, for God's sake and for their sake, let us be kind. Men who followed McLaren in his parish in Scotland, some of them who came 20 years after McLaren had left the scene, said that even 20 years later, the fragrance of his ministry was still there. Very few folks remembered his sermons, although many of them were masterpieces. What they remembered, many of the adults who were then children, was that when they were sick, McLaren would come not to visit their parents, but he'd come to visit them. And he would sit by their bedside and he would tell them stories. And as a result of his stories, the frettishness would disappear and they would be made comfortable in their crumb-filled beds. This love of which Paul speaks is always patient because it just deals with people. And it is always kind. Now, having laid down that premise, Paul begins to tell us what love does not do. The first three things he singles out deal with the fact that there are differences among people, and love has to handle those differences. The first thing he says is that love does not envy. There is a legend that The devil was once crossing the Syrian desert. As he did, he came across a group of demons that were trying to tempt a holy man to sin. The demons were doing everything they could to make this pious man fall. They attacked him with temptations to the body, but he was unmoved. They whispered in his ear that living a holy life was just a waste of life. The holy man did not respond. And then Satan, watching the imps unable to succeed, said to them, look, when you're dealing with a truly holy man, special methods must be taken. And so the fable goes, Satan went over and whispered into the ear of this godly man, do you know that your best friend has just been made bishop of Alexandria? And according to the fable, a look of malignant jealousy crossed the holy man's face. That may be a fable, but if you know what it is to live before God, you know that there's great truth buried in that story. Many men and women who, by conventional standards, live godly lives often fall to the green-eyed monster of jealousy. A friend comes to tell us about her promotion, and as she is telling us about this new task she has, outside we listen, but inside jealousy clamps its teeth around our soul. Or we hear of a friend in seminary who has a large church and now has a national radio ministry. We still have a small congregation over there at the edge of the vineyard. And someone comes to say, you know, I hear this man on the radio every day, and what a marvelous preacher he is. I don't think I've ever heard anybody quite like that. And outside, because we're good Christians, we listen and approve. But inside, envy makes its attack. What small trifles cause envy to do its work? The secretary next to us gets a new typewriter, and we don't, and we're disturbed. Or a friend at church gets a new car, and ours is 5 years old. Or the neighbor's kids get on the honor roll, and they don't even have to study. And our kids give it 3 hours a night, and they have a hard time passing. And our neighbor comes over to tell us that his kids have gotten a scholarship to Stanford. We don't think our kids are going to make it out of high school. Before long, envy and jealousy begin to work. Jealousy can keep us awake at night. It can build walls between ourselves and other people. And Paul says that love does not envy. And in saying that, he says two things. He diagnoses the disease, and he gives us the remedy. Where love is gone, envy comes. But where love comes, envy goes. But I know that when you say that, it sounds like a platitude. Love does not envy. But since envy can do its desperate work in our lives, let's stop for a moment and think about how envy does that work. Envy thrives on differences. Our Constitution says that all of us are created equal. The founding fathers had enough good sense to recognize that we are not all created the same. There are differences in people, differences in gifts, differences in opportunities, differences in accomplishments. And envy thrives on those differences. For envy is what we feel when we see a difference in someone else that makes them seem superior to us. And it becomes the occupation of our soul. There are other sins that draw people together. We can have drinking buddies. But envy separates us. When I envy somebody, instead of that person being a person, they become almost a thing to me. When I see them, I think of their new dress, or the new house, or the new car, or the new typewriter. All I see is the difference. I don't really see a person. You say to me, all right, that's all fine and good, but I'll tell you this. I'd swap places with her if I could. Would you really? If you were going to swap with that person that you envy, then, of course, it would have to be a complete swap. You'd not only swap typewriters or cars, you'd swap marriages, husbands, or wives, or kids, or age. You'd have to swap your health for her incipient cancer. You'd have to swap your feelings of peace for a person's feelings of insecurity. When you start thinking about that, you're not quite so sure. Edward Arlington Robinson, in his poem, Richard Cory, expressed it well. He said, whenever Richard Cory went downtown, we people on the pavement looked at him. He was a gentleman from sole to crown, clean favored and imperially slim. And he was always quietly arrayed. And he was always human when he talked. But still he flooded pulses when he said, good morning. And he glittered when he walked. And he was rich. Richer than a king and admirably schooled in every grace. In short, we thought he was everything to make us wish we were in his place. So on we worked and waited for the light and went without the meat and cursed the bread. And Richard Cory, one calm summer night, went home and put a bullet through his head. When I envy somebody, I simply see some difference, some external. If I were to get down on my knees and pray for that person and pray for God's blessing on her, it's possible that I might get a glimpse on the inside and discover to my amazement that they too are caught on the barbed wire of life and deep inside are bleeding and hurting. How do you deal with envy? One thing you can't do is decide you're not going to think about the difference. If you do that, you usually end up not thinking about the person, and that excludes them from your life. I don't know what people outside the faith do about it, but you can deal with envy if, as Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 12, you recognize that God gives gifts and opportunities to his people according to his grace and according to his sovereignty. Listen, God has given you whatever you need to serve him. God has put you exactly where he wants to put you in order that you can represent him in the world. If God does that for you, and he does the same thing for other people. Now, you may not like the way God runs his universe. You may think the whole thing is a bit queer. But that's your problem. That's not his. You really believe that God is sovereign. And if you believe that the sovereign God is good, and that what he gives you is what you need to represent him in the world, then you can believe that God does that for other people. And if you will trust his sovereignty and really believe in his goodness, you can be content with what God gives you, and you can rejoice in what God gives others. Love does not envy. But then Paul says, love does not boast. if envy is what we feel when we feel somehow inferior to other people's gifts and opportunity, then boasting is what the strong sometimes do for the weak. We boast in order to show ourselves off, in order to put our goods out in the window where everyone can see them. The reason that we boast is that we want folks to know how good we are. In fact, we're not a bit disappointed if they think that we're really better than they are. As I said last night, boasting always thrives on comparisons. We really don't boast about our looks or about our wealth or about our talent. We always boast about the fact that we're wealthier than someone else, more talented than others, that we're better looking than others. That means that when I boast, I use other people as a platform for my virtues. I use other people to show me off. That's why boasting is such a heinous thing. It's perfectly natural to want to be liked. It's perfectly natural to want the things we do appreciated. Boasting simply takes that very natural urge and heightens it to the place of sin. The person who boasts is always interested in other people's applause. The question, what do they think of me, becomes the predominant question of life. As a result, like a cheap politician, what they want are people's votes. They really don't care about people themselves. As a result, when I boast, directly or indirectly, I really don't care about you. I just care about your thinking well of me. It's interesting that in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, the Apostle Paul gives us a view of life in which approval and disapproval doesn't come from other people. It really comes from God. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4 about himself, so then men ought to regard us as servants of Christ and as those entrusted with the secret things of God. Now, it's required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I don't even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that doesn't make me innocent. It's the Lord who judges me. Therefore, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait until the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness, and he will expose the motives of men's hearts. And at that time, each will receive his praise from God. You really believe that? God knows what you do. God knows why you do it. God knows everything about you. If you really live before God seeking his approval, then the approval of others matters very little. And you can be delivered from boasting. William Carey was a missionary to India. Early in his life, he was a cobbler. He repaired shoes. But he was also a man who had a brilliant linguistic gift. And later in his life, William Carey went to India. And as a result of Carey's ministry, the Bible was translated into 34 languages in the Indian continent. William Carey, while he was in India, lived in the British community. The people there in foreign service had gone to Cambridge and Oxford, and they had studied at Eton. As a result, they looked down at Carey as a less than educated man. One evening at a formal dinner, a man sitting at a table with William Carey, wanting to put him down, said a bit too loud, Mr. Carey, I understand, sir, that before you came to India, you were a shoemaker. William Carey said, oh, no, that's not accurate. I was a cobbler. I didn't have enough skill to make shoes. All I could do was repair them. A man who could look at reality about himself, who really didn't care about people's applause, but cared about people, was free to take India from God. Love does not envy, and love does not boast. What is more, he says, love is not puffed up. You see, it's possible to be puffed up, proud, and not envy, and not brag. You can have enough style to be modest. Ah, shucks, I couldn't have done it myself. I needed the line to help me get the touchdown. Now, there are people who boast, who are really dwarfs trying to sound like giants. Down inside, they feel all shriveled up, but they feel if they talk big, folks won't know that inside they feel small. But you can be puffed up because you really think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. And when you're puffed up, proud, you can look down at other people. You can look at other folks, other Christians, and think they're not quite where you are. They're not quite at your level. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1, Paul puts his finger on one of the things that puffs us up. He says, knowledge puffs up. Love builds up. And boy, knowledge can do that. Go through seminary, get a little Hebrew, a little Greek, and you lay that on God's people. And they sit in awe of you and you know, you really know that you know the Bible. You may not know God, but you know the Bible. You can do that when you come to Forest Home. You can go back home and you've learned something in the sessions. And other folks pray the Lord's Prayer and they never thought about their daddy. But you have. There's a way of just looking down at them. You ever notice how many other immature believers there are in your church? Very seldom do folks say to me, I'm an immature believer. But they are. It's very easy when you get a little bit of knowledge for it to turn putrid like stinking fish. Knowledge just puffs you up. And deep inside, you really think that you're better than you are. And other people are less than you. Oh, you could do it in a lot of ways. There is a pride of face. There is pride of place. There is pride of grace. You know all those people on welfare? They're lazy. I'm not on welfare. You know why I'm not on welfare? Because I'm not lazy. That's why things are the way they are. And when you think that folks are lazy or indolent or are working the system, and you're not working the system. Oh, you get an income tax deduction because you've got a house and you can take the interest off. You don't pay the full fare on your plane ticket. You're on the dole there. The government supports a great deal. Oh, but that's you know, middle class. You look down at people. You never love them. You never experience a relationship with them. You see them as something less than yourself. And you're puffed up. That's the essence of pride. And it destroys relationship. Because instead of reaching out to people, we are constantly judging them. How do you overcome pride? You must understand, pride is not the same thing as conceit. Conceit is a pimple on the skin. Pride is a disease of the blood system. Just as Modesty is not the same thing as humility. Bishop Gore said a very helpful thing. He said, humility is to see myself before God in my true value. It's to see others before God in their true value, and to live before God in His true value. The only remedy for pride is to really understand the grace of God. Do you understand what grace is after the theologians get through with it? They say that grace is unmerited favor. What that simply means is that everything you get from God, you don't deserve. God never loves you because of what you are. God always loves you in spite of what you are. God never loves you because of what you do. God always loves you in spite of what you do. You can never get one up on God. You bring that old bookkeeping mentality over into the new life in which you think if you do a number of good deeds, that's sort of like shooting par in golf. But when you're really doing good deeds, you come to Forest Home every year and you memorize the Bible and you do things at church, you're one or two up on God, and now God owes you. Look, God doesn't owe us. God owns us. You never get to the place where God owes you blessing. God's love is always unconditional. You never deserve it. God never loves you because of what you are. God always loves you in spite of what you are. If once it gets through our heads that if we have to go up against God on our own, we'll never make it, we suddenly begin to understand grace. And you need the grace of God tonight if you've been a Christian 40 years, as you do if you're just coming to know Him tonight. You need the grace of God tonight as much as the pimp or prostitute on Skid Row in the rescue mission needs God tonight. You don't outgrow God's grace. You're always in need of it. When suddenly it dawns on you that everything I have comes from His hand and I don't deserve it. Anything worth having comes as an act of grace. And I realize that all these differences among men don't matter with the Almighty. To live in the grace of God destroys pride and produces humility. That's what Paul means when he says, what have we that we have not received? It is by the grace of God that I am what I am. And if you believe that, you know grace. Let me tell you something. If you knew me like I knew me, you wouldn't sit here tonight and listen to me. And if I knew you like you know you, I wouldn't stand here and talk to you. That's the fact of life. And yet God in His grace will accept us and work with us and deal with us and never stop. To know grace is to know humility. Because when I see God in His true light, I see myself in my true light. And when I see myself, I see my sin. And when I see my sin, I cry out to God for grace to help in time of need. And what a difference that makes. If God deals in grace with me, then He deals in grace with the person sitting next to me, with the people at the office, the other folks in the family. And when I look at someone else and say, there's someone that God loves as deeply as He loves me, then instead of being inflated, I simply live with folks as we are, objects of the grace of God. This love of which Paul speaks is always patient because God's patient with us. He doesn't deal with us according to our sins or reward us according to our iniquities. And God is kind. If you started to count God's blessings, that's all you would do. They are showered upon you daily. And to know that is to be kind yourself. And this love of which he speaks deals with differences. It doesn't envy. It takes what God does for me and recognizes that God in his grace can do things for other people. It doesn't boast. It doesn't live in comparison with others. It just lives to help others. And it's not puffed up because it knows that it lives in the grace of God, and that God's love is not deserved and never merited. And that makes a difference. Because love like that, instead of building walls, builds bridges. I have a friend who's a lover of good music. He told me that when he was a boy, about 8, he went to his first concert in Carnegie Hall in New York. He and his parents got there a bit early, and the orchestra was already assembled, and they were tuning up. He didn't know they were tuning up. He sat there, and he listened to this barrage of sound, and couldn't imagine that his parents would come into New York to hear something like that. Then he said he remembered the conductor coming out and raising the baton. Suddenly, all of those instruments played together. In the orchestra, the flute is not inferior to the trumpet. And the violin is not inferior to the bass drum. And the man who plays the bells is not superior to the woman who plays the harp. They simply play together, and they produce harmony and music. When Christians live in love with one another, we begin to play the music of heaven, the kinds of melody that people listen to before they listen to the words. To live in love is to live knowing there are differences. But in spite of the differences, reaching out for the highest good of others. This love of which Paul speaks is to characterize our lives. And look, you're better at it than you think you are. Because that's what God's doing in your life. This is the kind of person he wants you to be. By this shall all men know that you are his disciple, because you love one another. Let's pray. Father, we're very well aware of the fact that we bobble it, often more aware of how others sometimes fail to lack in love towards us. But there are those folks who, when we meet them, really seek our best, really encourage us and lift us up, rejoice when we rejoice and weep when we weep. And how different that makes us feel. And how different that makes us live. Grant that this shall be true of us as we represent you in the world. Grant this for Jesus' sake. And Lord, grant it for our own sakes, and for the sake of those who have to live with us.